Well, I have an article that was in the Spokane Chronicle. But that was written, we had two friends, we were, of course, in Kodiak, and we had two friends from college that were on the staff of the Chronicle. One of them was the Northwest editor, and the other one was just a reporter. And I don't remember how they got through to us, because we didn't have any phone, but they did, and asked me to write a story. And that was, well, the date's up there. That was written when?
April 16th, 1964, so about 2.5 weeks after.
It's more interesting because it was, I had to get it right back to write a story. I was a journalism major in those days. And
how old were you when this happened?
How old was I?
Yeah.
You were what?
I was 9. Mom was almost 39.
Well, it was in 64, and I was born in 25.
Old enough to remember it better than I do. My 9-year-old memories are pretty indelible. And just to give you a little background, we moved to Kodiak in 1962. My dad, her husband, had just graduated from Church of Indy School of the Pacific, and this was to be his first church. So he was priest in charge at St. James the Fisherman Church, which was... actually not a building when we moved there. That was the first job, was to build a building. And so we had been there a little bit less than 2 years. And so we were excited to be there. It was a fascinating place, lots of places to explore and lots of roads out of town to go exploring the Passaic Shack, the beach with all the fossils, and the, a lot of roads left over from World War II days. And so a lot of people were... into exploring the island, which was kind of a fatal mistake for some of the people that day. So.
We didn't have mail service or anything. The downtown was all enclosed by the Marines.
Yeah. We should tell them what happened. It just started to shake. And Mom and Dad had lived in Juneau during the LaToya landslide, and which caused a huge wave. And so they kind of knew about earthquakes and such. And we were at, Dad was at work at the church, which is about maybe half a mile down the street. And the rest of us were all at home. And Mom says in the article that she felt shaking and she thought it was my brothers wrestling. I had two older brothers at the time. Well, we had three brothers. One of them was very young, and then my sister. And so, you know, boys get kind of rambunctious. And so she assumed it was they. Let's see. They were, Don Jr. was 13. Bob was 10. My sister was 4. And my little brother was
18 months.
And we were living in a small house. They hadn't built the rectory yet. And so we were living in a small house. So, you know, shaking was not unusual. And so, anyway, that was Mom's first reaction. But then it didn't stop. And so
did it get worse then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she has a pretty vivid description in here. I stooped to pick up 18-month-old Jeffrey and could hardly straighten up. I told the children to come by the front door. I sat in a chair by the door with Jeffrey on my lap and my arm around 4.5-year-old Jennifer. My first thought was to go outside until I looked out and saw swaying power lines in front of our house. I remembered reading somewhere the safest place in a house was under a door jamb, so we stayed where we were. The jolting increased. A totem pole on top of the bookcase wavered and fell to the floor. Something crashed in the bedroom. I prayed silently. Jeffrey began to whimper. Jennifer started to cry. Her tummy hurt. Just an hour before, she had come down with the stomach flu. Susan, Bob, and Don Jr. remarked this earthquake was worse than the one before, referring to the one we'd all gone through in 1958 in Juneau. Anyway, a week earlier, I'd mentioned to my husband, priest in charge of St. James the Fisherman Episcopal Mission, that I wished Bob were a little more enthusiastic about attending both services on Sunday. Now it was Bob who said, "Mother, pray out loud." I did. The house was shaking and rattling so vigorously, I hoped my voice would remain calm. The bookcase in the hall was about to tip when the earthquake gradually subsided. We learned later it had lasted 2.5 minutes. And they say that it actually was even longer than that. It's up to 5 minutes with the, you know, the crescendo. And the,
it's kind of a rolling. Well, you were very, I mean, it was really scary, you know.
Yeah, the power lines outside were dancing. The mud puddles were sloshing. It was just really a a startling experience, especially when you're in it, you don't know when it's going to stop. I mean, when you read history, okay, you have a minute more to go, but it's like it just kept going. We knew to, they had a broadcast, of course, that was back when you had to get your transistor radios out, because the, she talks about the fact that the radio transmissions were disrupted. The Navy base is around the corner. It was a Navy base, now it's a Coast Guard base, but 7 miles away. And so the communication was cut off from the two entities. And, of course, they had the more high-powered equipment and so forth. But Armed Forces radio went off the air, power failure at the base. Power in the town was still on, but at 6:40, we, too, were without power, so about an hour after the quake. We asked Bob to get his transistor radio, hoping to pick up any shortwave reports. A neighbor rushed over. Did you notice the cars going up Pillar, meaning Pillar Mountain? A tidal wave is coming. The report just came over our transistor. And so that was the big worry, of course, after an earthquake.
How close to shore were you?
We weren't. We were up on a hill. We were up on a hill probably, maybe a mile from the shore, would you say?
Less than that.
Yeah, and up a hill. So we weren't in any danger, but again, the unpredictability, you don't know how big the wave will be. And so in an air of caution, we followed the parade up Pillar Mountain.
So how long between the actual quake and the wave?
It was about, must have been about an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's not a wave, it's a surge, you know. And
I remember, even though I was really little, I remember looking across, and Mom talks about it in her article. There, we used to go to a church camp at Woody Island. It was the Baptist camp, but everybody went. And so we looked across, you could just see this little ribbon of foam. And then there was a blue dock light, and the dock light disappeared. So
we had seven surges or something.
Yeah. It struck me how naive people are about tsunamis. I had to laugh because my husband and I moved to Ketchikan. He was working for a local bank and was in charge of all the operations. And we got a report, as we often do being on the rim, that there had been an earthquake in Japan or South America, and there was a tsunami warning for Ketchikan. And I said, okay, what's your plan? Because the bank was downtown. He goes, it's going to be okay. I said, I know, but you need to have a backup plan. Once you've been through something like that, and of course everybody just looks at you like, oh, Susan, it's fine. And of course nothing happened, but it just, I don't know if I could ever live on a beach after.
No.
Once you've been through something, it makes you realize what
can happen. It does, because it's striking. And it's frustrating, too, because we were up on the mountain with a lot of the town. And the only person that was broadcasting was at the top with a shortwave radio. And he was saying things like, we're all going to die, the island is sinking. And wasn't it your sister who was driving on the freeway in Los Angeles and heard that over the radio? And we're sitting there going, no, we're still here, but communication is so different now than it. I teach Alaska studies at K-High, and the kids, you know, trying to describe them, especially after the, just fast forwarding a minute, we didn't have phones for 2.5 years because the whole switching station got knocked out in the tidal wave. And I said, I don't think you guys could live with your phones for 2.5 hours. And so anyway, it was.
Well, there was no communication out at all. And but Dad was. The newest minister in town was always head of the Red Cross.
Yeah.
So he had contact, you know, and I said, please let my folk that lived in Seattle, that were fine.
Yeah, they had, didn't they have like a big barrel and everybody took their mail down like the next day and you could send letters out to people? The Navy was awesome through the whole thing. They had, we had Armed Forces radio and television, but they had an expert who had just been through an earthquake in Peru, and he would come on the television and talk, not just to people who knew all about this, it was talking to families. And, you know, when you know what you're going through, it's easier to understand and to deal with it than if you, the unknown. And so they would get on all the time and give us updates about this is what was happening and so forth. And so that was very helpful. And then the other thing they did was they shipped up a bunch of movies. I remember Nikki, Wild Dog of the North was one, like family movies that they put on television. Usually we had really old shows on television. But this was the newest and best, and it was a distraction for people. And so they were very kind in that regard, and it helped. And the kids, my kids asked me at school, well, Mrs. Stone, why don't you just go down and rent movies? I said, well, this was back before they
had 24-hour Disney movies.
Yeah. There was a huge line going up Pillar Mountain. We moved along past a water tower that was spewing water from a crack near the top. It was clear and cold, about 25 degrees. We went about a mile up the mountain before the line of cars stopped. We wrapped the younger children in blankets and settled down to wait. For once, Jeffrey sat still. Jennifer continued with her stomach flu. We thought to look at our watches, and it was a little after 7 p.m. and getting dark. The men stood around outside their cars talking. A nearby car with a radio reported the earthquake had damaged other parts of Alaska. We prayed for the safety of the people in Valdez, Seward, and Anchorage. A man's loud voice said, here comes the wave. We looked out the car window, saw Woody Island, a white line on the horizon. It looked so big. Were we high enough? Soon the wave moved closer. It seemed ever so slowly, and the rocky spit jutting out from Woody Island disappeared. Then the blue light on the Woody dock. We could not see the Kodiak Boat Harbor or downtown area below us. The town was in darkness. Fishing boats out in the bay bobbed about like tiny lighted buoys. About 9 o'clock, cars were beginning to turn around and go back down the mountain. We did, too. We passed people still walking up the mountain. Some were carrying tiny babies. The youngest children in our car had slept the past hour, cuddled under a mother's, a brother's, or a sister's comforting arms. When we reached our street, it was jammed with cars. This was high enough ground, it seemed, for everyone except the people who lived there. I remember one of the things that we were impressed with was the ACS, the communications, we heard on the radio, and they were calling all of the fishing boats to determine their whereabouts and if they had survived the wave. And of course those, and you'll see stories of it throughout South Central Alaska where they unleashed boats to just go out to sea because it's safer to be there. And so some of them were able to do that. So Alaska Communications System operator called the various fishing boats. We could hear only one side of the conversation, but it was obvious that some were safe, some were on the beach, others did not respond. And one of them, the Salif, you'll hear stories about, because that's the one that we had a school, an elementary school, that was in an old building above town, and the Salif was just down below it on the beach. Well, it wasn't on the beach, it was in the middle of town. And it just gotten dumped there. And so that was kind of, you know, the ridiculous irony of all of it was pretty amazing.
Well, that operator on ACS got a national award because she stood by her microphone for 2 days solid.
Yeah, and just a really steady voice. I remember that.
Yeah,
just,
and then she said, the Salif, are you there? Are you there? Yeah, if you look out your window, we're right out in the yard of the school.
Throughout Saturday, which was the next day, we were worried about our families outside. We knew communication had not been established, only via ham radio and relay by ships at sea. A friend of mine and I wrote short notes, which were taken to the post office by armed sentries guarding the disaster area. And that's one of the things I remember was driving downtown the first time.
Yeah.
And first of all, there was the main road through town, and there was a house right in the middle of it. But I tell my kids at school, it looked like somebody just scooped up the whole town of Kodiak, dumped it back down, and poured it full of mud. And you could see the water lines on some of the buildings that hadn't been displaced. And one of the hardest things was that about 2 years afterwards, we'd have these aftershocks. And they weren't just gentle aftershocks. I remember there was one the next week that everybody was back in school, but nothing had spilled out of this one medicine chest in the bathroom, but this clunk had just thrown everything out. It just hit just right. And so that was a little disconcerting. And Dad had to fly to Anchorage to check because of Red Cross. And didn't you have to sleep with a transistor radio under your pillow?
I did. I slept with because it was always rumbling for weeks. So I had an old those were the days of transistor radios, and I had one under my pillow so I wouldn't hear the rumbling, which, you know, continued. And
yeah.
We had ice cream for breakfast. And
yeah, we didn't, and our water was fouled. It was not.
Why'd you have ice cream for breakfast?
Because we didn't have any power. It just was melting. I mean, everything in the freezer was melting. It had to be thrown away. So. We
so you
thought
might
that
as well.
Was real intriguing. We never got that.
Yeah.
We didn't have any power, and I remember this was in the days before disposable diapers, and I remember Mom was out there with the hibachi trying to heat up water to wash Jeffrey's diapers. People don't know how good they have it with disposables.
Well, so, the Marines had taken over the town, and so
you had to protect it. So, and then Easter morning, Dad had services at sunrise for a group of unshaven, warmly dressed parishioners. Most of the homes were still without electricity. Easter Sunday was more significant than ever to us all. And about 6 p.m. Sunday evening, our electricity was on, and we also had running water. How thankful we were to be warm again. And throughout that, in fact, I think it wasn't during his Easter service, they came in and the trooper said, you know, there's a report that we might have an even bigger wave coming in. And so everybody had to kind of be on high alert. And so people, I remember, left church early to get home to their families and that. And so, and of course, people were naive. They went down to watch the wave come in. There was the grocery store and Donnelly and Atchison, Kraft Foods and Donnelly and Atchison were next to each other right on the boat harbor. And there were people, they had to scoop people out because the wave, the surge was starting to come up, and they were standing in ankle-deep water going, you know, just so fascinated by it all. And they scooted them out of there and up to higher ground. So
the band teacher at
the band school. Teacher, maybe I was reading somewhere else, the band teacher and his whole family were out clam digging on a beach. And that's where, you know, when you got out the road, which was, you could drive like 30 or 40 miles, couldn't you, out the road, like to Passaic Shack. And they were just on one of those beaches. And they were from, I think he was from Nebraska. And people from Middle America don't understand about tsunamis and didn't make the connection. And so they didn't know to go to higher ground. And I don't think they ever even found their bodies. I did find one article. It's kind of interesting. This is one that was just in our family annals. But it talks about the people who had died in the earthquake. Kodiak Island, 22 dead, 50 presumed dead, and some of those people were later found. They say that it's amazing that more people were not killed. If it had been today, there would be far more damage than there have been then. But I think there were 132 people.
Is that just because there's more people in Kodiak?
Or there are that many more people who are from outside, or that many more people who live on the beach. Anchorage had a different kind of earthquake. They had where the earth opened up. It's built on more silt. Kodiak was solid rock. In fact, Mom said in her article she used to complain about having to haul in dirt to get flowers or grass to grow. And she, after going through the earthquake, the fact that we held together so well and didn't have those yawning chasms open up. But anyway, through this article, there's an article about, there's a picture of a family with Santa Claus, and all those children were killed on a beach in Oregon. They were camping with their families. And right here, memory of victims of a wave are vivid. And of course, it talks about people who died on the beach at Crescent City, California. And so,
guess I mostly just heard about tsunami hitting Alaska.
No, the
I guess
whole
I didn't
wave
realize
just,
it was mm-hmm. the entire West Coast.
It was kind of a freak, you know, because of the cycle of the wave. And so people on the beach were camping, and
they figured it was initiated on Middleton Island, mm-hmm. which they give on the news every night. The weather was one of the weather points.
Was the epicenter, or
mm-hmm.
of the earthquake?
I guess it was where it began.
Yeah,
didn't name it or anything, and
So anyway, that, you know, it kind of reminds you of why I will take the tsunami warnings more seriously probably than anybody else in my family who goes, it's okay, Mom. But a lot of people, you know, when you get a warning, you should probably take it. So I have to tell you one funny story that I found this. I was hoping I would find this, but this is from the, of course I marked it, now I lost it. This is from the 1964, the world in 1964 as we lived it, the Anchorage Daily Times, and the Associated Press. And it has a month-by-month description of events that happened. And, of course, March, Anchorage made the title page because this was Turnagain Arm, which is amazing because now people are building back on Turnagain Arm. And so, but anyway, the opening of the story, I thought I would share with you, and I think it's at the end as well. It was 5:20 p.m., Good Friday, March 27th, on a hill overlooking the harbor of Kodiak, Alaska. A carpenter was hanging a new cross above the altar in the sanctuary of St. James the Fisherman Episcopal Church. Louis Horn, the carpenter, chose two small eye bolts to suspend the heavy cross from the ceiling. "Do you think these will hold it, Louis?" asked the Reverend Donald Bullock. "Sure, Father. Even in an earthquake?" The minister was joking. Alaska had had many tremors, and everybody took them for granted because nobody could remember an actual quake. "Even in an earthquake," the carpenter said, grinning. Afterward, people would remember the little ironies and what they were doing at the time and the prophetic behavior of animals. Someone in Anchorage remembered that just a few moments before, his cat had wailed louder than ever to get out of the house. Louis Beatty, a rancher on Kodiak Island, remembered that the cattle had behaved strangely. About 3 o'clock that afternoon, the herd suddenly turned from its low-lying grazing land and moved to higher ground. They had never done this before so early in the day. Why now? The rancher studied the scene around him but found no explanation. The sky was sunny and blue. The mountains stood serenely in their skirts of snow. The wind blowing in from the turquoise sea was gentle, seeing nothing unusual. Beatty could only guess that the cattle had sensed something was wrong. But what? What indeed? Had there been a seismograph that day to measure the sum of human feeling, it probably would have recorded only a benign stirring and stretching in the mood of Alaska on this Good Friday of 1964. And then the story closes. The great convulsion had permanently reshaped the earth in many places. In uninhabited Montague Island near the earthquake's epicenter in Prince William Sound, it had raised the land as much as 33 feet. Under the devastated harbors of Seward and Valdez, it had lowered the ocean floor by as much as 150 feet. It had shaken, cut, dropped, heaved, and twisted the earth many places, but in the little church overlooking Kodiak Harbor, it had failed to shake loose Father Bullock's new cross.
We were a missionary district, so we had to get word to New York that we were all right because the crazy guy in his car saying the island was sinking.
So how did you get word out? Was that through the Navy?
But I remember they had a place downtown where you could take mail. This is my recollection, but where you could go down and deliver a letter, and then they would fly in a Navy plane to Seattle to dispatch those letters as quickly as possible out to family. And then they also had flights out of there. There were some people who could not stand being on an island after something like that occurred, and they were giving people passage out of there. The other thing that happened, too, is you remember Gene Dixon, the predictor of events. She predicted Kennedy was going to be assassinated. She was kind of the trendy, I don't know the polite term for interesting lady, but anyway, she of course predicted that Kodiak Island was going to sink the Tuesday after at 11 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, you don't believe that stuff, but as 11 o'clock drew closer, people were on their porches looking around like, I don't believe it either, but... But anyway, we didn't sink, so that was good. Good to prove her wrong.
And it was kind of scary for us because every once in a while an ambulance would drive by up to the house and with bodies. And Dad had to go do whatever he did.
Yeah, it was really sad. Although Mom talked about some of the damage. She said, Kodiak isn't the same, nor is the coastline to the north and south. The downtown area is a mess of controlled burning of debris and misplaced buildings. Just north of the city limits, Mill Bay Road had run just above the beach and along both Potato Patch and Mission Lakes. Now a portion of the road is always underwater, and both lakes are saltwater lagoons. The lovely Baptist Mission above the lake was above the rush of the waters, although they did lose some of their storage buildings. The beautiful homes of retired Dr. Johnson and his son were formerly on high ground between Mission Lake and the sea. Now at high tide, they live on an island without a water supply. homes on the shore of Mission Lake have seawater up to their lower levels. Farther along Mill Bay Road, sloping sandy bays are now harbors deep enough for fishing boats. The peninsula has sunk noticeably. Bridges and roads are washed away, and the bays extend much further back into the mountains. Calson Bay will always bring sad memories. It was on this beach that the high school band teacher, his wife, and three others, two of them children, were digging clams when the waves hit. All were lost, some of them still listed as missing because their bodies have not been found. Now it's been verified that Kodiak Island has sunk 5.5 feet. Tides have been running that much higher ever since the waters were calmed after the giant waves. Perhaps the downtown business district will have to be moved to higher ground. She said, I used to complain about all the rocks, how you had to bring in topsoil to plant flowers and grass. Now I'm thankful Kodiak is such a rocky island. At least it held together and sank in one piece. So that was a pretty dramatic change. And watching a town rebuild after something, so because everything was downtown. I mean, we lost our movie theater, the grocery store, the dry goods store, the
bars.
The bars. And, of course, you can guess what came back first. The bars. And some of the buildings that went up quickly were not very attractive. You know, the old ramshackle would be a good word, too. Some of them, it's interesting, I was thinking about the post office was up a hill, kind of like the downtown was here, and then up a little bit higher with post office, and then the building which now houses the museum where the Erskines lived and who wrote a book about the 1912 volcanic eruption, which dropped a layer of ash on Kodiak. But that was up higher. The Russian Orthodox Church was up on a hill. But all the dock areas and the main part of downtown was washed away, including the telephone station and the...
So how long did you live in Kodiak after the earthquake?
So 5 years.
Yeah, we left in 69.
How rebuilt was the place by the time you left?
Well, Dad was on the city council and the borough assembly. So we hardly ever saw him.
He was concerned about how we were regrowing, and he was concerned about the quality of life with what kinds of buildings were going up. So he wanted to be a positive energy. And, of course, some people told him to get back on his hill to the church. But it's amazing how a community bounces back. I mean, how they pull together. Everybody really pulled together. People from all over the United States sent, you know, money and goods. My mom's aunt had a dress shop in Sunnyside, Washington, and she sent up the barrels of beautiful clothing from her store. And her dad was a food broker, and they were concerned that we didn't have water, and five kids with no water, they were concerned. So I remember one of our grandpa's suppliers was Treetop Apple Juice, and so they sent a case of apple juice up for the family. And so I can't drink apple juice today without hearkening back to that memory. And that was in the days before bottled water and all that stuff now. But they were concerned about the water supply, just all the sloshing and the reservoirs. And then they were concerned about a lot of people had to get immunized for, you know, subsequent things. We had earthquake training in our schools. We had to rearrange all of our classrooms. They had to say, okay, where would the glass from the windows likely go more toward the center of the room? So they lined our desks up closer this way so everything would bounce into the middle of the room. And they took all the centers out of our light fixtures so that they wouldn't jostle out and drop on a child and that. And so we were just trained that, and it did, it shook all the, I mean, you just didn't ever know when you were going to have an aftershock. So they became very much a part of our.
But you don't think about the tragedy because you're so busy. And it was strange. Mm-hmm. The Red Cross came in and they're the ones told us about the kind of people that are attracted by disasters, you know.
So did you encounter some of those people who came in and tried to take advantage?
It was far enough off the beaten track. We didn't get too much of that.
And then nobody could get to the island. They were shuttled just for that reason.
Yeah.
Red Cross teamwork. That's what I learned about people attracted by tragedy.
Yeah.
You were telling me about people who just left. They couldn't stand living there. What made you decide to stay?
Well, that was his job. He just graduated from seminary. We lived in California for 3 years, and this is where the bishop assigned us. And we stayed. We loved it. I mean, it was very different then. You know, people from church that came to church in their boats. Their way of life, you know, they have cars, some of them.
And the church people built the church literally. The building itself was built from wood salvaged. The Navy would sell off these buildings they were disassembling from. They didn't need them after World War II. They scaled back. And so a lot of the corpsmen and the guys would come in from the base and literally help build the church building. And that, in fact, I brought one of the, I thought this was kind of an interesting, if I could put my hands on. Oh, there's my mom's other article. Did you have any other stories in there, Mom? Because you had to write that.
What's that?
Class. That's that story that you wrote for that class. When Kodiak was devastated by the tsunami resulting from the March 27, 1964 major earthquake, this parish family made the decision to build the rectory as a symbol of faith. And Father Buck was also instrumental in starting the annual service for fishermen called the Blessing of the Fleet, which continues today. And so it sort of prompted faith that life's going to go on, and we need to take care of each other. And I think the one thing it did was it did put Kodiak on the map, and a lot of people traveled there. For instance, we were the king crab capital of the world. And it was after that, after we'd been on the, kind of made the map after, with all the stories, that there were people that came up to work in the canneries and college kids there and bigger boats from Seattle. And
well, up to that time, the biggest boats were the same boats, just like we have in Ketchikan. Mm-hmm. And so there was this excitement about what happened to the king crab. Mm-hmm. Because they were just using the salmon boats to catch them. And so that was a positive point, you know, focus for everybody.
Yeah, people just pulled together.
Were you frightened to stay, though? I mean, was there part of you that wished you could go?
Well, you mean,
I don't think so. You know, it's just such a part of life in Alaska. And, you know, we were up on a hill, and so I think we felt safe from a tsunami, but I don't know. I bet your parents probably wanted you to come back, but they never wanted you to go to Alaska in the first place. So.
What?
I said your parents probably wanted you to come back, but they were never thrilled about you going to Alaska in the first place. So.
Maybe we had to be sure that New York knew that we were not dead.
Yeah.
Washed off the
church
world.
Was still there. You know, it's funny, I don't think people thought about, you just kind of dug in and dealt with it. It's kind of interesting. Some people weren't that way. Some people really couldn't stand it. And it was a little bit, I mean, I remember when that Gene Dixon prediction, you don't believe in that stuff, but it's like, it was a little unsettling, but once 11 o'clock came and went. And after a while, I think the first couple of tremors sort of brought it all back and were scary, but after a while it was like, oh, here we go again. And so we just kind of took it in stride.
Yeah.
And of course, I think disasters can bring out the best in people too, you know, with pulling together.
City Island had sunk.
So it was.
Was it about 8 feet?
Five and a half.
So high tide, you know, the highway, the roads were underwater till low tide.
It definitely changed things.
But you're so busy with. And I was worrying about getting that written for the boys.
So. Yeah.
So with the rebuilding, did they have to rebuild on higher ground because it had sunk, or did they just bring in a bunch of fill? How did they?
Yeah, that's where.
Well, all the lots were erased. So that's why Dad had been elected to the borough assembly and the city council, because he was
had a remap
not part of, we didn't have any property in town or anything, and the church wasn't built yet. The rectory was partly built, started.
Yeah, they didn't really even talk about, I think some of the buildings were a bit farther back, you know, from the shore. But if you look today, it's still right along the harbor. The breakwater is higher, but a breakwater doesn't really protect you from that kind of stuff.
But they had to replat the whole town because of
all the markers were blurred.
Yeah, they're gone.
But it's almost like it just stripped the top layer off. There was rock underneath, and so as far as that goes, it was stable ground. It was just the mud on top of it. That...
Have you been back?
They have. I haven't been back. You know, you always go the other way to go visit.
Right.
And
yeah.
So...
It's kind of out of the way.
It is. And oftentimes you might get stuck there for an extra day or two. So, but I was laughing because our youngest daughter just went to work for Alaska Airlines. And so, of course, now we get parent benefits. And I said, oh, I could take my kids on a pilgrimage back to Kodiak. My siblings have been back there.
Is the church still there?
Mm-hmm.
Is the cross still there?
I think, I don't know if they have. I think when I saw a picture, the cross is still around, but I don't think it's the main cross in the...
I don't know. It looked like it.
It was huge.
Bev Horn wrote that book.
Was it oak? It was an oak cross. It was given to church by the family of a gentleman who came out from Virginia. And so it was had the brass ring and the oak. It was heavy. And so, but it's there. It's part of the annals of history. So.
I was taking care of five kids.
Yeah. But yeah, it was an interesting experience. It's funny how you remember. I mean, I don't remember a lot of details. But you kind of do because it's such a, that's the lake that became a lagoon. You know, it's such a startling experience. And then, of course, reading, you know, stories about it sort of always brings it back up and stays in front of your mind. So, but yeah, it was a good place to grow up. It was